about Democrats and Republicans. It's about restoring the Constitution's checks and balances to the Trump administration.
Regardless of where you start out in life, if you work hard, if you do it for the right reasons, you can succeed in the United States of America.
The pundits laughed at us, but they did not get the point that we were never in this to win an election. We were in this to change politics irrevocably in this country.
Securing the border and defending the Constitution and the Bill of Rights. That is a common sense agenda that unites Texans from every part of the state.
Thank you for believing in me and for hearing our message and for giving me your vote.
In Colorado, we dream, we dare, and we do.
In the absence of anyone giving a clear voice on the moral issues of our time, then it is up to us to voice them.
Let you down.
I want to encourage you not to give up.
I will work every day.
They will not forget the once forgotten.
We do what others said was impossible.
I commit to devote my heart, my mind, and my energy to be worthy of the trust that you, as the voters of Utah, have given me.
I'm as inspired, I'm as hopeful as I have ever been in my life. And tonight's loss does nothing to diminish the way that I feel about Texas or this country.
I'm grateful that Donald Trump knows and remembers the heartland of America.
You don't need special interests. You don't need lobbyists. You just need the people.
Every call you made, every door you knocked, every text you sent, every conversation you had made the difference.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Tanzina Vega. Millions and millions of Americans voted in yesterday's election, and today we're bringing you results and analysis all hour long. And there's tons to talk about, so let's get to it. I've got Amy Walter, host of our Friday politics show, with me, and Amy is also the editor at the Cook Political Report. Hi, Amy.
Well, hello, Tanzina.
We made it, Amy. We're here.
So far.
Coffee in hand. So, Amy, there was so much talk about blue wave, red wall, back and forth. Last night you tweeted that this was the choose your own narrative election. What did you mean by that?
It is exactly that. There was a blue wave and there was a red wall. They just happen to be in very different places in this country. Another way to say this is we have an election that was held in one country, but the results suggest that we live in two different Americas. One where Trump is popular. A lot of those Senate races that Republicans picked up are in states that he carried easily in 2016 and where his approval rating is still over 50%. States like Texas, Florida, Arizona, Missouri, Indiana, Tennessee, North Dakota, all of them have something in common. They now have either Republican senators or Republican governors who won last night, some of whom knocked off a Democrat. But in the House, where suburban districts were critical for Democrats to pick up the seats that they needed, the president is deeply unpopular. And in fact, what I'm really struck by, Tanzina, is just how different the national House race numbers look from the overall outcome last night, if you're just looking at some of the statewide results. It reminds me a lot of another election you might remember, 2016, where the popular vote winner and the electoral vote winner were two different people.
Yeah. Let's bring in our two other voices today for our roundtable. We have Aaron Haynes Wack, who's an Associate Press national writer on race and ethnicity. Aaron, welcome back to The Takeaway.
Thanks so much for having me.
And we have Yamiche Alcindor, is the White House correspondent for the PBS NewsHour, and she's actually joining us from the White House briefing room. Yamiche, thanks so much for being with us.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
So to everyone here at the roundtable, women, of course, were also the huge story of the night. More than 100 women were projected to win seats in the House, and the majority of them were Democrats. Was this a surprise? Was this a women's blue wave? Yamiche, your thoughts.
I think that it wasn't a surprise that there were several women who were elected as the first. This election was a lot about women because of the Me Too movement and this idea that women were really asserting the fact that no means no, and that any sort of sexually inappropriate behavior is really unacceptable. people in this day and age. It's also important that the president himself stands accused by several women of sexual misconduct and sexual assault. So I think the president was also a galvanizing force for women to start running for office. And a lot of these women were not recruited by the Democratic Party. A lot of them actually bucked the establishment and said, I'm running anyways. You saw that in Massachusetts, who now, with that state now has their first African-American woman going to Congress. So I think it was, in some ways, this was predictable, but it's still a very remarkable end.
Erin, you wrote about these historic wins. There were the first indigenous women, Muslim women, as Yamiche mentioned earlier. Can you tell us a little bit about some of the big historic wins that happened last night?
Absolutely. So, yes, you did have race and gender dominating last night's midterms, and those historic gains did include several trailblazers. For example, two Muslim women will now join Congress, Ilhan Omar and Rashida Tlaib. You also had two Native American women joining Congress for the first time, Deb Haaland and Cherise Davids. Obviously, you had a record number of candidates of color and also women running, and a lot of them were victorious. And I think that, frankly, their victories are calling into question the traditional establishment notions of electability, about who's old enough. Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, for example, is going to take her seat in Congress at the age of 29, the youngest woman ever elected to serve in Congress, or who's experienced enough. You had a lot of first-time candidates like Lauren Underwood, a nurse out of Illinois, or Johanna Hayes, a teacher out of Connecticut, or who's well-funded enough, or who's able to represent a district that isn't non-white, and whether they can really appeal to white voters or men. I think a lot of these firsts proved that, those conversations about electability are pretty much off the table going forward in politics, and that is probably going to inspire a lot of women and candidates of color going forward.
And, you know, on the flip side to that, we saw rising Democratic stars like Andrew Gillum in Florida and Beto O'Rourke in Texas who lost. And really, this came down to some razor-thin margins. And I'm wondering, Amy, what you think this tells us about the progressive strategy that these candidates decided to take on.
Well, it just goes to show that we don't quite have an answer for how best for Democrats to win in some of these swing states. There is going to be a lot of Monday morning quarterbacking from some Democrats who say, well, maybe especially in a state like Florida, that is always razor thin, Democrats would have won the governorship had they picked maybe a more centrist candidate. But in Texas, a state that Hillary Clinton lost by 9 points, Beto O'Rourke came very, very close, which suggests that that strategy certainly was much more effective. But again, in both of those places, it's cold comfort if you come up short. And in politics, you only have to get one extra vote than the other person in order to win.
Yamiche, you've been covering the Republican races around the country, and we know that the Democrats took the House for the first time in 8 years, but Republicans still hold the Senate. I'm wondering what that means, or what you see that means for the Trump agenda moving forward.
Well, I think for the Senate to still be held by Republicans means that President Trump can still get the number of votes he needs to confirm a Supreme Court justice. And that's really important for evangelicals and for, or I should say, for white evangelicals and for white Christians who have stuck with the president despite all sorts of scandals. So I think it means that the president is still feeling good about his chances to keep promises to the people that at sometimes have questions about whether or not he's too brash or too blunt for politics. But I will say, last night I spent all night at the White House, and Kellyanne Conway, the White House counselor, came out and talked to reporters for 28 minutes. It was almost like a mini press briefing. And all she kept saying was, well, at least I should say one of her main points she kept saying was that the president sees the Republicans keeping the Senate as evidence that his presence makes sense, and that his closing message, which was really about immigration and about fear and fearing American diversity, running an ad that was deemed too racist by Fox News, CNN, NBC to even run on air, that the president feels good about his closing argument, and he feels like his agenda is really validated by the fact that Republicans kept the Senate.
Go ahead, Erin. You know, that really calls into question the role of racism in this election cycle and how that is going to bode for 2020. I mean, we saw a lot of racist rhetoric on the campaign, from robocalls to dog whistles from candidates, and even, you know, President Trump's remarks on things from the migrant caravan, you know, urban crime or questions of competency among some candidates. But that was a winning strategy. There is a portion of the electorate that does respond to that.
Amy, you mentioned that earlier when we were talking before the segment, that the president likes to make it all about him. And in fact, where he won, it was all about him, right?
Yes, it certainly was. And going back to the issue of, you know, the president nationalizing this race, then, especially on issues that he loves to talk about, the very divisive issues, the caravan, Democrats wanting to have open borders, et cetera, that may have been successful strategy in some of these states where the president, again, remains popular, where he won by big margins in 2016. But boy, was it toxic in these suburban, especially suburban upscale white districts where they rejected the Republican candidates there. Many of those candidates weren't messaging those same Trump statements. They were trying to talk about the economy. They were trying to talk about other issues. But it didn't matter because a lot of those voters in those states said, I may like the economy, but I don't like what Donald Trump stands for. And they voted Republicans out.
And this is where I'm sort of feeling that there's going to be a little bit more gridlock, Amy. I'm wondering, one side says they're going to investigate. The other side wants the subpoena. I mean, is this really going to unblock the blockages?
You know, the fact that we have Democrats in control of the House, Republicans in control of the Senate, and then President Trump, to me, it reminds me of, I don't know, whatever, I'm not a chemist, but whatever the most unstable form of a chemical is what we're talking about. And we have no idea how that's going to react in the hands of the president, in the hands of Democrats. Democrats haven't been in power in the House in quite some time. Many of the people in Congress right now on the Democratic side have never been in the majority. How they handle this is going to be very interesting to watch. And of course, the president, there's no predictability with this president on how he's going to react to the investigations, the subpoenas, and then how Democrats are going to react to the reaction of the president. So it does seem like this is a very unstable environment in which it could easily blow up in the faces of the president or the faces of Democrats, too. This is the first time since 1970, by the way, that the president's party, there's been a split decision where the president's party loses seats in one body but gains in the other. Normally, again, a wave election means the party in power loses across the board. So he can say it is correct. He upended one part of the sort of traditional midterm outcomes. On the other hand, this House race situation, I don't think he totally appreciates how different his life is going to be and that of his aides come January.
Yeah, Yamiche, are you getting that sense as well? Because remember, you know, we're coming up by the end of the segment here, but there's also the Robert Mueller investigation happening behind the scenes.
Well, there's no doubt that this Democrat-controlled House is going to be a thorn in the side of the president, and he knows that. Late last night, the White House was quickly saying that Democrats shouldn't waste their time looking into the president's finances, looking into the president's tax returns, looking into whether or not you should be able to hire your daughter to work at the White House. Those are all old questions from 2 years ago that now Democrats in some ways can bring back up and say, hey, these are all things that are still not right. So the president, I think, is possibly feeling a little worried, a little anxious about that. And it's really going to be really hard to see what the White House can work on with Democrats, because this White House says that they want to work on infrastructure and other things. But my guess is, and I've talked to some Democrats, they don't want to hand President Trump any sort of victories in their 2 years that they're going to have here. So it's going to be really hard to get anything done other than possibly funding the government. But I wouldn't be surprised if even that would be a problem.
Amy Walter, host of the Takeaways Friday show on politics, Aaron Haynes-Wack, Associated Press national writer on race and ethnicity, and Yamiche Alcindor, White House correspondent for PBS NewsHour. Thank you for a fantastic roundtable, ladies.
Thank you so much.
And we want to hear from you. How are you feeling today after last night's results? Better yet, tell us what song represents the way you're feeling. Give us a call at 877-8-MY-TAKE with your anthem of the day. And again, that's 877-8-MY-TAKE. And we'll put together a day after election soundtrack. President Donald Trump addressed the country from the White House today in a muted press conference to put a spin on the results.
It was a big day yesterday, an incredible day. And last night, the Republican Party defied history to expand our Senate majority while significantly beating expectations in the House for the midterm and midterm year. We did this in spite of a very dramatic fundraising disadvantage driven by Democrats' wealthy donors and special interests and very hostile media coverage, to put it mildly.
The results the president mentioned, Republicans gaining in the Senate and Democrats flipping the House, were expected. President Trump then listed the names of several Republicans who lost, blaming their losses on not embracing his politics.
You had some that decided to, let's stay away. They did very poorly.
He also went after one of his favorite targets, CNN chief White House correspondent Jim Acosta.
Mr. President, I had one other question, if I may ask, on the Russia investigation. Are you concerned that you may have—
I'm not concerned about anything with the Russian investigation because it's a hoax. That's enough. Put down the mic.
Mr. President, are you worried about indictments coming down in this investigation? Mr. President.
I'll tell you what, CNN should be ashamed of itself having you working for them. You are a rude, terrible person. You shouldn't be working for CNN. Go ahead.
So what does all this mean for Republicans in Congress and for President Trump's agenda? For that, we turn to Doug High. Doug is a Republican strategist and has worked in multiple communications positions in the House, Senate, RNC, and also served in the George W. Bush administration. Doug, thanks for joining us.
It's good to be with you. Thank you.
So we have a shift in power. Majority of power in the House now comes to the Democrats. That means the Democrats will set the schedule and shape the agenda. They'll also have the power to pursue investigations into the president's business relationships. What is the reaction from the Republicans been so far?
To use a dating term, it's complicated because depending on who you talk to, you're going to get very different reactions. If the House is your priority, last night was terrible. If the Senate's your priority, last night was actually pretty good. And then we've got a mixed bag with the governor's races as well. There's kind of a straw for everyone to grab at. But I would say the most significant thing is the House of Representatives, for exactly what you mentioned. Not only are House Democrats going to investigate President Trump like he hasn't been thus far, but also his entire administration, and they'll have subpoena power. And that not only will force the administration to take its eye off the ball as it deals with countless investigations, but also runs the risk of, you know, ratcheting up the rhetoric as we've seen over the past couple years, to where if we thought that politics were divided yesterday, I think they just got a lot more so.
Well, let's talk about that, because we know that the president called Nancy Pelosi to congratulate her. We heard Nancy Pelosi, House Minority Leader, come out last night and say she was going to promise some level of bipartisanship. Is that talk, or do you really think that? It sounds like you don't think that that's really going to happen.
Well, look, this is the talk that you always have after the elections, and you know, Donald Trump also tweeted, you know, a very positive thing about Nancy Pelosi, you know, and how she should become speaker. That's not what we would have expected from Donald Trump just as recently as 24 hours ago. And I do think that there are opportunities for Trump to try and be the great negotiator that he's, you know, always told us that he is. And specifically on issues like tariffs, where he's much more aligned with Democrats on infrastructure, for instance. Most Democrats that I've talked to have thought for 2 years now that if Trump had led with bipartisan infrastructure, that would have put Democrats in a real box. My concern over the next 2 years moving forward is, and I say this having worked in House Republican politics during the Clinton impeachment, is that the investigations and the enthusiasm around them tends to take on a life of their own, and it becomes hard for leadership to really rein in the horses as much as they may want to.
And this has been a very difficult, if you will, political cycle, at least since the president has taken office. It's been very contentious on both sides in many ways. But I'm wondering, was this a repudiation of Republicans or those that support the president, or was this something different?
In part, it certainly was. We're seeing this be more than 10 seats than were needed, and there may be a few more out there. That's significant, and also significant because we're in a place where the economy is doing particularly well, which is typically where voters react to. So if they're not reacting to this with a House turnover of 35 seats or maybe a couple more, clearly that's a referendum on the president. And then there's also the demographic divide that we've seen really only increase. And suburban areas are more Democratic today than they were 2 years ago, regardless of what state they're in. So think of like suburban Dallas or suburban Houston. And rural areas are more red. And I think one of the things that both parties should be concerned about with then is that that divide is deeper, and it's now harder for Republicans to win urban votes and for Democrats to win rural votes.
Hey, it's interesting you mention that, because I recall, and I'm sure you recall, after the 2012 election, the GOP had to do some soul searching. And one of the things they did was said, you know, we need to become more diverse. We need to start focusing on voters of color. And now we see this real hard turn. So did the GOP take anything away? Are they going to do some sort of similar autopsy, if you will, so they can prepare for 2020?
Not in the same fashion. I'll tell you, in the days after the 2012 election, I was in Richmond, Virginia with my then boss, Eric Cantor, as he was calling Republican members to say, you know, what did you see? What did you hear on the ground and so forth? And if we're talking the week after the 2012 election, I would tell you that some form of immigration reform is more likely to pass the House than isn't likely to pass the House. And as we moved day to day after that, that stopped being a top tier level of concern for pick your Republican member of Congress and their district. But it became more of a national problem. Well, that's the National Republican Party's problem. That was Mitt Romney's problem. It's not my problem in the congressional district that I represent. I think some of that attitude is still true. And also that how Trump campaigns on immigration has certainly drawn a lot of criticism. It tends to help Republicans in those areas where they need help. And if you're a rural Republican voter, you're not pushing for any form of comprehensive immigration reform. And that really then stymies Republican members.
Hmm. Doug High is a Republican and has held communications positions in the House, Senate, RNC, and served in the George W. Bush administration. And he's also a contributor for CNN. Doug, thanks for joining us.
Anytime. Thank you.
Tuesday wasn't just about the candidates and the parties. Voters in 37 states also weighed in on 155 ballot measures. And here on The Takeaway, we've been covering those initiatives, and today we've got the results. In Washington state, despite grave warnings of climate change, voters rejected a proposal to tax carbon emissions. Here's John Ryan, an environmental reporter for KUOW in Seattle.
A disappointing night for climate activists. They were on the losing end of the most expensive ballot measure fight in Washington history. A gusher of money from the oil industry seemed to make the difference. The Carbon Fee Initiative aimed to make Washington the first state in the nation to adopt a carbon tax, or fee, to fight climate change. But voters almost everywhere, except in liberal Seattle, rejected that idea. Climate activists and scientists say time is running out to preserve a livable climate.
Over in Massachusetts, voters delivered a major win for transgender rights, choosing to keep a bill that protects the rights of transgender people in public places. And in Montana, voters chose overwhelmingly to extend funding for public colleges. Kirk Carapeza is managing editor of our partner WGBH's Higher Education Desk, and he'd been following the measure closely.
More than 60% of voters said yes, and about 40% voted no. Since 1948, every 10 years, Montana voters have supported this tax. It provides an annual funding base for the state's public colleges and universities. It's also the only tax of its kind in the country. Supporters of the tax see it as a Montana tradition that keeps higher ed more affordable and accessible for Montana students and families.
Over in Alabama, voters overwhelmingly approved a ballot measure allowing the Ten Commandments to be displayed in public schools. And up north in our 49th state, Alaskans said no to what's known as the Salmon Initiative, a measure over whether to increase regulations for salmon habitats. Here's Elizabeth Harbaugh, our reporter with Alaska Public Media.
By a wide margin, voters in Alaska defeated Ballot Measure 1, commonly known as the Stand for Salmon Initiative. The measure was aimed at increasing protections for salmon habitat in Alaska. It would have significantly toughened the environmental permitting process for mines, dams, and other big projects. Alaska is home to some of the richest wild salmon fisheries in the world, but the initiative faced intense resistance from the oil and mining industries, Alaska Native corporations, and unions.
Voters in Missouri overwhelmingly decided to legalize medical marijuana, joining more than 30 states that have some form of the drug available. Here's St. Louis Public Radio reporter Jason Rosenbaum.
Missouri became the latest state on Tuesday to legalize marijuana for medicinal use. They did that by passing a measure known as Amendment 2. Amendment 2 would set up a state regulatory framework that would allow for the cultivation and sale of medical marijuana. A 4% tax on the marijuana would go to run the program and would also go to help veterans. Passage of the initiative comes as many Republicans in the state legislature have become more amenable to medical marijuana.
And in California, San Francisco residents said yes to raising corporate taxes in order to increase funding for homeless services. KQED political reporter Marisa Lagos says homelessness was one of the biggest issues to Bay Area voters.
It's very visible in cities like Oakland and San Francisco. There are tents with people living in them. We've just seen a spike in the sort of, you know, street visibility of homelessness. And then there's, of course, all those invisible homeless people like families who may be living in cars or doubling up on couches. I know that in some schools in San Francisco, there's been a huge problem with school children not having stable places to live. So I think it really has reached a breaking point, and it's something that pretty much everyone is looking for solutions to.
And Louisiana voters overturned a law allowing for split juries to return a guilty verdict. It was a controversial law dated back to the Jim Crow era and was the only one in the U.S. that allowed juries to return murder convictions without a unanimous decision. Coming up, we'll look at one more ballot measure we've covered on the show, this one from Florida.
Support for this podcast comes from Babbel. People around the world are learning new languages with the Babbel Language Learning app. And you can too. Learn Spanish, French, Italian, German, Russian, Swedish, and more with Babbel's 10 to 15 minute lessons. Babbel users say they're amazed at how fast they learned and that they are confident in speaking their new language. Start learning a new language today. Just go to Babbel.com and use offer code TAKEAWAY to get 50% off your first 3 months. That's Babbel, BABBEL.com, offer code TAKEAWAY for 50% off your first 3 months.
Some 1.5 million ex-felons are now eligible to regain their voting rights in Florida. Not since the Voting Rights Act of 1965 have voting rights been so widely expanded in one fell swoop. On Tuesday, voters passed Amendment 4 in Florida, the constitutional amendment to restore voting rights to convicted felons who have completed their sentences. People like Devin Coleman.
One of the key points of being American, of participating in the democracy that we have, is the ability to vote. So if you can't vote, you're not included in that process. And that's a hurtful feeling.
Coleman has been out of prison for 12 years. And thanks to the passage of Amendment 4, he will now be eligible to vote once again. Steve Bosquet is Tallahassee bureau chief for the Tampa Bay Times, and he's been following Amendment 4 from the beginning. Steve, thanks for joining The Takeaway.
Thanks.
So, big night in Florida. Walk me through the lifetime ban on voting rights for felons. What was the law and what is it now?
Yes, what was the law was implemented by Rick Scott, who it appears is going to be Florida's next United States senator. A person who is released from a state prison and completes all the terms of their sentence, including restitution, probation, community control, anything like that, must then wait 5 years. Five, to apply to have their civil rights restored, and the application process frequently takes years. After what happened last night, 65% of the voters who voted in this state, and we had a big turnout, voted for Amendment 4, which basically says when you complete all the terms of your sentence, you automatically get your right to vote restored, with two exceptions: people who've committed murder and felony sex crimes. So a legal fight is looming, it appears, over how it's going to be actually implemented, because we have a Republican legislature that has traditionally been hostile to this idea.
Well, and part of the reason I'm assuming it's been hostile to a certain extent is possibly because many of the people who have been disenfranchised are people of color and Black Americans. Is that part of what's happening here?
Well, they're not going to say that publicly, but that's certainly a factor, especially going into the next presidential election in 2020. Keep in mind that even though we had close elections on Tuesday in Florida, we have apparent Republican victories for Senate and governor. One of them is still the Senate race is still close to being in the recount window here. But it's a deep purple state. And even if half, let's just assume for the moment, even if half of those 1.2, 1.3 million who are affected by Amendment 4 were to register to vote, that's 600 and some odd thousand new voters. And our reporting and research has shown that a majority of them would be Democrats.
And that could have had an impact on, for example, the Gillum race down in who's from Tallahassee.
No question about it.
What about nationwide, Steve? What about nationwide? What implications could this have?
Well, Florida is a true outlier state. There's no other state that is remotely as big as Florida that has a lifetime ban like this. But this I checked again this morning. This amendment passed in 61 of 67 counties. It failed to get a majority only in six very small, rural, very conservative North Florida counties, which means it's very important. Many, many Republicans, most Republicans voted for this, not just Democrats.
That is quite a surprise. Were you surprised by that, Steve?
Well, the polling suggested it was in a good shape to pass. But, for example, Amendment 4 got more votes than a widely advertised crime victims amendment, which had broad support from law enforcement and community groups and professional athletes and so forth. Amendment 4, though, the ACLU raised more than $5 million. They had an aggressive advertising campaign down the stretch. There was no real visible opposition to Amendment 4. This was a true example of the Citizens Initiative working in Florida, and the Citizens Initiative is really a way for people to take the law into their own hands and bypass the legislature.
Never a dull moment in Florida. Steve Bosquet is Tallahassee Bureau Chief for the Tampa Bay Times. Steve, thanks again.
All right, thank you.
We now turn to the state of voting yesterday. There were reports of long lines, broken voting machines, and voting delays and other irregularities recorded in Georgia, Kansas, Texas, and other states with tight races. Some polling officials admitted to being unprepared for higher-than-average voter turnout, while malfunctions with new and old voting machines exacerbated long wait times. And during today's press conference, reporter April Ryan tried to ask President Trump about voter suppression efforts in Georgia.
Well, I'll give you voters. I will give you voter suppression. You just have to sit down, please. Sit down. I didn't call you. I'll give you voter suppression. Take a look at the CNN polls, how inaccurate they were. That's called voter suppression.
Brenda Wright is a senior advisor at Demos and an expert in electoral reform issues. Brenda, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thank you.
So, Brenda, yesterday we saw tweets and social media and posts on Facebook with people talking about long lines, machines that didn't work. In one particular instance, there was a voting station in Georgia that didn't even have cords, you know, to connect the machines. Overall, what was your assessment of how voting went yesterday when it comes to suppressing the vote?
Well, we believe at Demos that democracy is at its best when everybody votes. And the good news, I guess, is that there was very high turnout overall. The bad news is that there were so many obstacles that voters had to overcome in order to make their voices heard. And in too many places, those obstacles really prevented people from being able to vote. We saw that in North Dakota, where Native Americans were turned away from the polls because they didn't have a residential address. They used a P.O. box instead. We saw, as you mentioned, incredibly long lines in Georgia. And some of the problems we saw were probably the result of bad planning and inadvertence and neglect. Other problems were the result of election administrators making very bad choices that put too many burdens on the voter.
So I want to dig into some of the bigger issues here, but let's pivot to Georgia for a second. What happened in Georgia? Do we know if any of these voter suppression tactics potentially could have affected the vote?
Well, we know that, as you mentioned, Gwinnett County has been sort of ground zero for some of the worst voter suppression tactics that we've seen in this election. We saw Gwinnett County trying to impose what they call an exact match requirement, so that if an election official thinks that your signature on your absentee ballot didn't exactly match the one that they have on file, they were going to throw your ballot out. Advocates had to go to court to get a court order to stop that practice. Gwinnett also was a place where there were a lot of malfunctions in the election machines and very long lines of people waiting hours and hours to vote.
We also saw on Sunday there were Brian Kemp, Georgia Secretary of State, did accuse the Democratic Party of election hacking with zero evidence that that happened. That's according to the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. Is there anything to that accusation, or was that sort of nerves and last-minute pandering, if you will, to distract from what the outcome could have been?
Yeah, it seems like it was nothing but a huge distraction. There were concerns about whether hackers had tried to get into the system. And Democrats advised the Secretary of State, who was running for governor, of those concerns. And he turned around and decided to launch an investigation against the Democrats instead of investigating whether there had been an actual problem with their systems. And I think that the spotlight has been on Georgia so much in part because you have the situation of the person who makes the rules for the election being at the top of the ballot himself and having been caught on tape saying that he was concerned that too many people in Georgia were going to come out and exercise their right to vote and that wouldn't be good for his party. I think that's just a shameful example of failed leadership on election administration. We need people to be running the game in a fair way, and it's not a game. It's our democracy that's at stake here.
There were a couple of other issues around the country. I'll just read through them very briefly. There were reports of machines that didn't work, including here in New York City, New York State, California, and Arizona. There were reports of machines that were changing voters' choices in places like Pennsylvania, North Carolina, and, of course, the tight race in Texas. There were voters in Houston who said they didn't speak English and they were not able to have interpreters join them, which is something that is allowed under the Voting Rights Act. And apparently in Maryland, there were precincts that ran out of paper ballots. That was something else we were hearing. Can you give us a sense of how, Brenda, first of all, how can a polling site run out of paper ballots? How are these issues sort of cropping up in places where we should have smoother voting processes?
Well, you know, I mean, that's a very important point. You can deprive people of the right to vote if you're trying to, and you can also deprive people of the right to vote just because of neglect and bad planning and inadvertence and not having enough supplies on hand, not having enough paper ballots. That should not be rocket science. It should be something that election administrators can figure out. And, you know, in most places in the country, election administrators do a great job, but the spotlight is always on the places where voters have such a struggle, such a difficult time in making their voices heard.
Could this be, could these incidents be any related to the gutting of the Voting Rights Act at all? Or is it just indicative of, you know, bad planning, as you said, and not enough resources?
Well, I think that it's really both. This is now the second federal election we've had without the protections of Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act, which the Supreme Court struck down in 2013. And I think what we're seeing is that Justice Ginsburg was right when she wrote in her dissent that getting rid of the Voting Rights Act because discrimination has been reduced is like throwing out your umbrella in a rainstorm because you're not getting wet. And we've thrown out that umbrella, and unfortunately, voters all over the country are getting drenched.
And let's talk about the national picture here. There was a coalition of civil rights groups that reported that they received more than 29,000 complaints of voting irregularities as of 8 o'clock last night. Is that comparably better or worse than in the past?
I don't have those numbers off the top of my head for comparison, but I know that in just about every election since the 2000 election, the coalition, the Election Protection Coalition, has been running these hotlines. And it's really unfortunate that year after year, election after election, they're still fielding thousands and thousands of calls from voters who are having trouble at their polling place. We should be able to do a better job. We can do a better job, and we must do a better job.
Brenda Wright is a senior advisor for legal strategies at Demos. Thank you, Brenda.
Thank you.
The makeup of Congress isn't just changing along party lines. Across the country, women and people of color have made record-breaking gains. Rashida Tlaib is with us now. She's a Democrat from Detroit, Michigan, and she's become one of the first two Muslim women elected to Congress, along with Ilhan Omar of Minnesota. Representative-elect Tlaib, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thank you for having me.
And Deb Haaland is on the line as well. She's a Democrat from New Mexico and has become one of the first two Native American congresswomen, along with Cherise Davids of Kansas. Representative-elect Haaland, thanks for being with us.
I'm so happy to be here.
Want to get started with you, Representative-elect Tlaib. What are you feeling today? What does this moment mean for you?
You know, there's so many emotions that comes with when you work so hard the last 9 months, going door to door and trying to uplift your neighbors, your residents, getting people engaged to come out and vote. Not because we were trying to make history, but more importantly, because we wanted something different, someone that, you know, had some sort of courage and a moral compass. So many of us know that, you know, half of the members of Congress right now are millionaires in an income bracket that is not reflective of the majority of Americans. So they wanted someone that understands college debt, understands not having access to health, good quality health care or, you know, equity in education. And I'm just really anxious to get the, you know, started and hit the ground running. I'm so pleased to be able to walk into the United States Capitol side by side with women like Deb Haaland, who also is incredibly inspiring for someone like myself.
And Representative-elect Haaland, what about you? What are you feeling today?
Well, gosh, I am with Rashida. I've been on this campaign for 18 months, you know, including the primary. We all worked really hard, and so it is really nice when you work that hard and win. It's definitely exciting right now, the day after the election. And likewise, I'm ready to go and do some work for the American people. There are people hurting out there, people who are worried about health care, worried about their children's education. We need to fight climate change and find alternative ways of producing energy that doesn't harm our environment. Those are all things that are important to the people in my district, and I intend to go to Congress to work on those things.
Representative-elect Tlaib, you have been a very vocal critic of President Trump. Can you tell us a little bit about your plans to push back against the Trump administration once you're in Congress?
Well, like I told my 13-year-old son, you know, we got to make sure that bullies don't win. I know people don't want to oversimplify it, but it's pretty clear that we want, you know, some sort of language and rhetoric and behavior that comes out of the White House to be reflective of our values as American people. I mean, I know from my mother and father being a child of immigrants and some of the discussions about immigration have been so dehumanizing for so many of my neighbors here in the Metro Detroit area. And I just want to be able to push back against a lot of that hate. The fact that someone like myself and Deb Haaland are elected at a time right now is very dark in our country. This is a moment of light and a rainbow of women, not just myself and Deb, but Ayanna Pressley, Jahana Hayes. I mean, you've got amazing, incredible women with such courage going to the United States Congress. That kind of courage is going to help push back against that rhetoric that, you know, for my son who questions whether or not he can tell a person he's Arab American or if he's of Muslim faith, I don't want my children growing up in that kind of America. I want them to grow up feeling very proud of who they are and where they came from.
Representative-elect Haaland, you know, as I'm sure you know, climate change is predicted to be one of the biggest things to influence our society in the very near future. And it's been an issue that you've been passionate about. Why was it so important for you to put this issue at the forefront of your campaign? And were you surprised that there was a real lack of talk about climate change from other folks on the campaign trail?
I am a lifelong environmentalist. And I think regardless of whether that issue polled high or not in my district, I still would have ran on climate change because it's a conversation that we all need to talk about. It needs to be at the forefront of our public discourse. We have, you know, 22 years before climate change is irreversible. Species of animals and insects and plant life will go extinct if we don't do something about this. Plus, New Mexico is a state with 310 days of sun per year. So economically, it makes sense that we should move forward with renewable energy. I think it would create thousands of jobs in my state, as well as help folks to have lower electricity bills. So I just think it's a good idea. I think it's a win-win for a state like New Mexico, and I think we can make that happen across the country.
And Representative-elect Tlaib, there was a lot of anti-Muslim rhetoric leading up to this election, but also just generally in American politics. Do you think your election could help mitigate some of that?
You know, what's so incredible in the spray that's behind someone like myself or even Ilhan Omar, who also is another Muslim American woman that just got elected, is that the majority of people in our districts that voted for us were non-Muslim. They were not, they did not share the same faith as she and I. I think hers is 70% white. Mine is the majority, 60% African American, the rest white. Very, very small, less than 5% are Arab American with mixed faith. What is very clear is that people wanted different and they wanted a moral compass. And, you know, when I ask people, I thank you so much for supporting me, they say, well, we just like that you have this fire, that kind of fight that we really need right now. Look, I'm replacing someone like John Conyers, who voted against the Patriot Act when it was very unpopular to, voted against the Iraq War when many of his colleagues in the caucus did. And that kind of courage that you get growing up in one of the, you know, most African-American or blackest city in the country is that fight to push back against things that are anti-civil rights or un-American. So for me, that's what is really the story behind this. Not as much about Islamophobia, but the fact that people voted for me that did not share the same faith as I do, not more because of my actions in the past and because of my passion to make sure that they have a seat at the table.
Rashida Tlaib of Detroit, Michigan, has become one of the first two Muslim women elected to Congress, and Deb Holland of New Mexico has become one of the first two Native American Congresswomen. Thank you so much for joining us, to you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right, everyone, that's our show for today. And on this day after Election Day, we want to know, what song is running through your head?
It's the end of the world as we know it.
A couple of you have tweeted your picks to us. Anthony Wright said, "It's the End of the World as We Know It" by R.E.M.
I feel fine.
And our listener, Anna Correa, picked this one.
Just make you turn around and see me cry. There's so much I need to say to you. So many reasons why.
Our guest Aaron Haynes Wack from the AP at the top of the show picks Stakes Is High by De La Soul.
Stakes is high. You know them stakes is high when you're talking about
And we got this call.
Hi, this is Lori Kay from Elk, California, and I wanted to leave a song of how I feel. I don't want to fade away. I don't want to fade away. What can I do? What can I say? I don't want to fade away.
Yes, Lori, sing it. What song sums up your feelings today, listeners? Give us a call at 877-8-MY-TAKE or tweet us at The Takeaway. Thanks so much for joining us. I'm Tanzina Vega. This is The Takeaway. See you tomorrow.
The Takeaway is supported by Progressive Insurance, providing tools designed to help customers consider options from multiple insurers. Comparisons available at progressive.com or 1-800-PROGRESSIVE. Now that's Progressive. And Staples, with print and marketing solutions for business, including color copies and presentations, booklets and manuals, signage and banners. More at Staples stores or staples.com. Staples.
You say it's not easy for you, and that you've been so
Since WNYC's first broadcast in 1924, we've been dedicated to creating the kind of content we know the world needs. Since then, New York Public Radio's rigorous journalism has gone on to win a Peabody Award and a DuPont Columbia Award, among others. In addition to this award-winning reporting, your sponsorship also supports inspiring storytelling and extraordinary music that is free and accessible to all. To get in touch and find out more, visit sponsorship.wnyc.org.